The Novel Ideas Podcast, a podcast with two siblings who love books.
We love books so much that we are willing to talk about them late at night before we have to wake up early the next morning.
That's right.
So you're welcome, listeners.
Yeah, that's right. We're staying up late for you. We're approaching 100 episodes, and we're still not good at it.
Well, I mean, I guess it depends on what scale you're grading us on.
That's true.
Although, I went back and listened to some of our older episodes expecting, like, to notice an appreciable difference in how much better we've gotten, and I was like, we sounded, like, exactly the same. Our quality of content, I think, is like just a big straight like plateau.
Well, that's either good or really bad.
you be the judge.
I know when I listen back and edit, sometimes I think we sound really smart if you ignore the self-indulgent giggling at our own terrible jokes. And I think that especially happens with classics. Maybe it's just because there's a lot to talk about, but...
I think it's easier to sound smart when you talk about classics.
You know, maybe that's what it is. And I wonder how much of our low research standard can be forgiven because we at least read the book.
If nothing else, we're a book club. We're both members of the book, both members of the club consistently actually read the book, so.
Did we ever talk about possibly doing an episode where we tried to read, like, the Spark Notes and just fake it like terrible students try to do?
You can do that, and then I could actually read it, and then I could, unlike... when I cannot yell at my real students, I can just say everything to you that I would want to say.
That could be fun.
No, that's bullshit. You clearly did not read anything.
Or sometime we could try to do it in reverse, like the next time I want to do some giant door-stopping science fiction novel. Like, I could reread Dune, and you could go watch, like, the...
I could read the Wikipedia article.
Read, like, or no, go watch the weird fucked up movie with Sting in it.
I love Sting.
Hey, the movie is weird. Oh no, my computer's restarting itself with my outline on it, and it didn't ask me if it could.
Hooray!
Alright, I'm going blind for the next 3 minutes, but I guess let's go for it. We should probably start the show.
Alright. So, this time around, we read Shadow Shaper by Daniel Jose Older, or I don't know. We don't know because we're terrible white people. So we picked this book because we read it, about ready for a YA, and we've been trying to consciously choose more women authors, more people of color, and this author happens to not be white, and as a nice bonus, it's a YA book featuring a largely non-white cast, which is pretty unusual, unfortunately, in the YA world. It's getting better, but still dominated by white, mostly white girls. So it's a little different, and it came out this year, so it's still pretty relevant, which means we should probably go ahead and instate our spoiler policy for everyone.
Yeah, so for anyone who isn't familiar with or doesn't remember our spoiler policy, we spoil everything because we kind of want to be able to talk about everything. So if that's going to bother you, now would be a good time to turn this one off until you read the book.
Yeah, because Sierra happens to be the new Lucera with powers to channel spirits.
That's right. In a shocking twist, the protagonist turns out to be the chosen one.
I don't know how much of a spoiler that actually is.
I mean, honestly, if you don't see that coming in a fantasy story, then
like, you don't read books.
You're
probably
just a little genre blind, yeah.
So yeah, Shadow Shaper. Oh, I was going to make a comment that this is definitely a book that will not take you that long to read. It's pretty short. The action moves very quickly. So if you're kind of debating whether or not to read it and you have an extra 2 or 3 hours, it'll be worth your time. I mean, it's not going to take you a huge investment to only be disappointed. So
yeah, it's short enough and interesting enough that just go ahead and do it.
Yep. Our endorsement.
That's right.
So genre, we believe it's urban fantasy. I wrote urban fantasy type YA novel. We're not sure exactly what classifies as urban fantasy, but Ben thinks basically if it's a fantasy story that takes place in a city, it counts. And this is a story with fantastical elements that does in fact take place in the city, so...
Yeah, it works for me. I mean, it certainly seems like a logical definition.
Yeah.
I guess the only urban fantasy I've really read is The Dresden Files. That seems like it would also qualify.
Yeah. This does not have quite as much magic as The Dresden Files, but it still has magic, so... I think it counts.
Yeah, it counts. That's what it is. We've decided.
Handed down to you. So plot synopsis is girl kicks butt with the power of love and art and dragons.
Hooray!
Which is pretty much just a straight up like summary. It's not a snarky synopsis. That's actually true.
Yeah, pretty much. I totally lost what I was going to say. Damn it.
Oh no.
Ben. I'm even freshly caffeinated. Like, I'm not going to sleep tonight, but I'm still not going to think clearly.
You're the reason that our recording quality has not improved all these years.
I'll wear that.
It's you!
I'll happily wear that.
Anthony would back me up.
Well, everybody who knows us knows that Gabs is better at everything in life than I am. Except for playing the trombone, but that's more proof that what I said initially was correct, probably.
If you're just looking for like a brief summary, so you can kind of orient yourself to what we're talking about. Sierra Santiago is a teenager living in the New York City area. Ben and I had this conversation where I think people who actually live in Manhattan would try to argue that this book does not take place in New York City because they're all snobs who don't think the boroughs count, but Ben and I believe that they need to be quiet and that it's basically New York City.
Well, yeah, I mean, I live in the Midwest and that concept doesn't even compute for me. So it's in New York as far as anyone is concerned who isn't living in New York.
Well, yeah, I mean, like, you know, we tell people all the time, or I tell people all the time, I guess, living in Boston that I'm from Kansas City, and then I tell everyone in Kansas City that I live in Boston, and technically neither one of those things are true, but really you're just, like, splitting hairs at that point, and there's no point to actually parsing it out. So, it takes place in New York City, and snobs can get over themselves. So, sorry, New York people. but follows a teenage girl named Sierra. She is painting a huge mural on a building, and her grandfather, who had a stroke about a year before and is usually unintelligible, tells her one afternoon that she needs to check out, like, figure out what the Shadow Shapers are. And she has no clue what he's talking about. And he also says she needs to find this kid named Robbie, who goes to her school. So she locates Robbie, tries to figure out what Shadow Shapers are. At the same time, there are these, like, weird corpse things chasing them around. And then she eventually finds out that Shadow Shapers can, like, infuse their art with spirits and actually, like, use it to do stuff, and it's pretty cool. So, that's a very general overview of the book, so you kind of know what we're talking about.
Works for me.
All right. I think one important point of the setting, I guess, that we didn't really mention is that it takes place in sort of the outskirts of New York City, so it's places that are have, like, not yet become gentrified and full of yuppies, or in places that are, like, just now becoming gentrified and full of yuppies. At several points during this story, they talk about being in this, like, coffee house that just popped up that sells coffee that's, like, all organic and blah, 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 but it's, like, way overpriced, which I'm sure everyone can identify with. So, I mean, that's part of the reason for the non-white cast feels, like, really natural as opposed to... It never feels like a white author, like, here, I put a ton of people in the book that are diverse. It just makes sense for the setting, and even, like, is able to offer some commentary on, like, what's going on in these areas outside of the city. So I think that's kind of an interesting, like, point to mention.
Yeah, they comment on it both in the sense that everybody has when they have to pay $4 for a cup of coffee, but also in the sense that it's kind of pricing out the people who have been living there for years.
Yeah, which is a problem in cities all over the country, I think.
Yeah.
So, I think very relevant. So, point of view tense, it's third person, close past tense, focusing around Sierra. I don't think it ever wavers from her point of view, like some books do occasionally for, you know, like a couple paragraphs at a time. This one just sticks around her, so we're trying to figure it all out with her. And if it's not clear by this point, she is in fact the protagonist of the novel. Extremely clear, no question here.
Yeah, I can't even make one of my stupid jokes about who else could be the protagonist.
Yeah, there's just, it's not even possible.
Yeah.
So kind of the opening of the story starts with Sierra working on a mural, kind of for the first time, like on the side of a building, and noticing that all the murals in the neighborhood kind of weirdly seem to be fading, and like no one really seems to notice it, and she has no idea what's going on. And later we find out that because Lucera is gone, that the power of the Shadow Shapers is fading, so the murals that they've all painted are also fading and losing power.
It's all symbolic and stuff.
Yeah, all symbolic and stuff. And I think like one of the characters in one of the murals, like she even sees like a tear fall down its face, like in the first or second chapter. So
yeah, there's kind of a hint of the supernatural before you directly get the supernatural.
Mm-hmm.
I guess it was a reasonable percentage of the story before things became blatantly magical, but it's such a short read that it didn't feel like it took that long to get there.
Yeah, I was going to say, because you have, like, the fading murals, and then you have, like, the attack of the guy who kind of looked and acted like a zombie, who you later find out is, like, this reanimated corpse-type thing, and a couple things like that where you're like, okay, this is not going to be, like, super realistic fiction.
Right.
And then, yeah, it tumbles headfirst pretty quickly into the supernatural. I guess you want to give a quick rundown of the characters?
Sure. So Sierra is kind of the smart, tough, capable type. What I call just the YA heroine character traits, really.
She actually has a sense of humor, unlike some other YA heroines.
Fair.
I will give her that. So she's not just like straight up like, I only do what I need to do to get things done, and I'm not good at making friends. Like,
right.
She has friends. She can joke. But she is also smart, tough, and capable.
Yes. And she has some teenage-type insecurities about teenage-type things.
Yeah, one of the things I liked about this, getting to read a book, like, from a different viewpoint, is it was kind of nice to see, excuse me, it never hit you over the head, like, oh my God, I'm not white, and here is like racism, and like that was never like a huge aspect of the story, but I liked how it was kind of woven in there. Like, this is part of her everyday life where, you know, sometimes she's insecure about like her body shape or her hair, but it's because of like the not white elements. So I thought that was kind of interesting that like some of her teenage insecurities were like typical insecurities, but then also came from like a different place than they might come from if you were reading like about a white heroine. And I just liked that because it felt like, well, that's something that people have to deal with that you might not think about if you don't have to deal with it.
Yeah, and I mean, part of, even though just a couple minutes ago, you said that the story, you realize, oh, this isn't going to be realistic. One of the things I actually liked about the book was that the characters in the setting do feel realistic.
Right.
They like, there's, the character interactions have like kind of a natural flow to them, and they kind of have like the bunch of buddies bantering thing going on, but it isn't quite like the bantering that's gone on in every other YA book I've ever read. And yeah, kind of to what you were just talking about, I think sometimes when white authors try to write a story about non-white characters, they go out of their way to make the story, look how fucking brown these people are. Isn't that weird?
Like, yeah.
Like, hey, it's a different experience, guys. Like, didn't you ever realize that?
The thing we've talked about before with some of the YA we've read, where it feels like it's hitting on all of the big issues that teenagers could possibly face.
Right.
So they'll be like, all right, here's, like, the black character who experiences horrible racism, or the Indian character whose parents are super strict or whatever, and like that's like their main plot point in this book because that's a thing teenagers have to face.
Yeah, and so maybe it's less of a like cultural commentary thing that I am noticing and more of just like a good old fashioned show don't tell sort of thing.
So this book nicely deals with that. Oh, yeah, and then unsurprisingly, as we've mentioned several times, she's also the chosen one, so, yeah, everything that comes along with figuring out you're the chosen one and embracing your power, etc.
Yeah, and does it in much less time than many fantasy protagonists, since those books tend to be 900 pages long.
I think one of the differences in this one is she doesn't know she's the chosen one for most of the book.
True.
So again, a lot of fantasy novels where it's like, you're the chosen one, and then you like struggle with it for like ever. She's like, what's going on with this? And then she runs into her grandma, and her grandma's like, you're the next Lucera. And she's like, oh, really? And then like in the next chapter, she's using her powers, so.
Yeah, right. Instead of, oh, what am I going to do with all this responsibility? Oh no, there was just like a crazy battle and people died because I wasn't strong enough to protect everyone. It's more like, oh, what is this Lucera thing? And oh, wait, oh, it's me. Oh, okay. Oh, hey, I have all this. Oh, God, these things are killing me. Wait, I have power. Now they're not killing me. The end. Hooray!
Basically.
That's my new synopsis. Let's go edit that back in the beginning. And so, of course, to go with Sierra in any YA story, you always have to have some sort of love interest. So in this story, that would be Robbie.
Yeah. And Ben and I have had conversations before where we would love to read YA stories without love interests. Robbie is not nearly as annoying as a lot of YA love interests, and like, the relationship between them is definitely not as annoying as a lot of relationships. Like, there's not a bunch of, oh, I love him, but I don't know how to love, like, nonsense going on. So I appreciated that, at least. So he is a quiet, artistic guy, always sketching awesome doodles at school, painting on walls and stuff. He is a shadow shaper and the one who explains the whole world of shadow shapers to Sierra, based on her grandfather's recommendation.
Yeah, he's almost playing the role of mentor as much as he's playing the role of love interest.
Mm-hmm.
Kind of showing her the basics, showing her the ropes, like, and, I don't know, almost as much as teaching or just confirming to her that some of the things she's seen aren't her going crazy or something.
Then he also serves to be the person who gets owned, like, 10 minutes after she learns how to use her powers.
Right.
Like, oh, shit, you're way better at me than me at this.
Well, I was almost going to say that he almost seems like an action movie type of love interest, where, and maybe it's part of the reason he's less annoying, because instead of interrupting, like, hey, here's this interesting magical premise and this threatening thing, now let's take 25 pages to explore why I haven't figured out how to love properly, even though I'm 16. I'm so old. Oh my God. And it's more like, hey, here I am. Oh, you're kind of interesting. I always thought you were the quiet one. Let me show you how to do magic. Great. And then action, 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 action. And yay, I get to make out with this person.
Yeah, that's true. There's just, like, a couple mentions of her being, of Sierra being like, well, you know, like, I tried to avoid being into boys, but it's not, like, a huge, terrible dilemma at her very core, where she's like, I refuse to love a man until I get to college, or whatever. The only question I had about Robbie is, like, he shows up, he's a pretty cool guy, but, It's kind of jarring to me, because, like, her grandpa says, you have to find Robbie. She's like, oh, that kid from school. And then her friend shows up and is like, come on, we got to go to a party. And she goes to the party, and Robbie is there. And then all of a sudden, like, they're talking, and then they're doing stuff together. And I was like, did she know Robbie before? Did they just, like, randomly both go to this party? And, like, her mentioning her grandpa was enough for them to, like, become instant friends. Like, I had, like, the lack of context with how well they knew each other kind of confused me. I didn't know, like, how long Robbie had been around or anything. So I was a little confused by that.
Yeah, there did seem to be quite a bit of trust pretty quickly, considering that it's the person I recognize from school, as opposed to, at least that was the impression I got.
Yeah. Well, and then they kind of brought up this question of, like, how trustworthy is he? Like, I think Benny mentioned that a couple times, and she wondered it once or twice, but then it never became, like, a really big issue. I never really seriously doubted Robbie's loyalties. So then, on that front, I was also like, I don't know. Like, was she never really supposed to trust him in the first place? Or, like,
Well, and kind of along those lines, and I promise I'm not skipping Benny, but there was a brief moment of questioning, like, how much can I trust Nydia, is how I'm going to choose to pronounce this.
Yeah.
A woman who works at the library at Columbia University, where Sierra was trying to figure some stuff out about all this shadow-shaping business. And there's kind of a moment of, oh, well, maybe this woman at the library is actually working for the big bad, and maybe it's something to worry about. And it basically gets resolved in, like, two lines of dialogue, because she's like, how do I know I can trust you? And Nydia says, oh, it's okay, you can trust me. And then Sierra goes, okay.
Yeah, right. Sounds good.
I mean, I'm not even exaggerating that much. That was almost the exchange.
I mean, it really is not that much different than that. Yeah, I thought that was kind of odd, too, because when Sierra thought it, I was like, ooh, yeah, like, I could totally see that. And then just a couple pages later, Nydia's like, oh, no, don't worry, I'm on your side. She's like, oh, okay, cool.
No, I'm cool.
I was like, wait, what?
Well, she says she's cool, so she must be cool.
Like, why was this brought up? That was the part I was confused about, like.
It's a fair question.
Why introduce this?
And so, Nydia, since I'm on the subject of her, is basically like a cool... Actually, I think she's supposed to be like a cool mom or something, isn't she?
Yeah, I think she has a couple kids.
Because she's supposedly in her... She's supposedly, like, at least twice as old as most of the teenage cast, but looks like she's a student still, apparently.
Yeah.
Which I'm not sure if that's a necessary or desirable detail, but it's there. And so maybe it's just to make her seem hip enough that she could plausibly, like, get along with a teenager on more than a purely, oh, sure, here's where you find this book kind of level.
Yeah. She's, like, a total, like, research librarian nerd, which is why she's at Columbia. She works in, like, these tucked away stacks of papers and... helps Sierra do some research on a guy named John Wick, who I think her grandfather also mentions. And he turns out to be this anthropologist guy who was following the Shadow Shapers around. So she's just trying to figure out more information about him to see if she can figure out what the heck is going on with the Shadow Shapers.
Yeah, and... I mean, I guess, do we want to talk about Wick, or do we want to go back and rope in a couple more of the buddies before we go that far?
Yeah, let's go ahead and round out the friends, I guess, real quick.
Okay. So Benny, who I referenced earlier, is Sierra's best bud. Kind of your standard loyal, snarky, smart-ass sidekick best pal.
Yeah. I'd say it's about accurate.
Yeah, we'll follow you to death's doorstep, meanwhile commenting on it along the way.
Yeah. She serves her function well.
Yes, she is reasonably good at her job.
Yeah, by the way, we decided that if our lives were a novel, that I would be the protagonist and Ben would be the smart-ass best friend.
There's no question. I'm definitely the one who would, like, my level of effectiveness would either be pwned the first time, like, a real challenge happened, or comic relief where I was totally ineffective but somehow survived anyway, and Gabs would be the one having to go through all the trials and tribulations and actually figuring out how to get us out of stuff.
I even have a capable love interest who can, like,
that's right,
do athletic things. So that's about Benny. And then the other character I'd kind of round out the teenage characters is Juan, who's Sierra's brother. He is also a Shadow Shaper, and he plays in a Latin metal band, which is interesting just because I've never heard of that genre before. Latin metal, I don't really know what that is.
I mean, I'm not surprised that it's a thing. I'm sure when I hit the internet to try to find a sample of it to be our intro-outro music for this episode, I'm not going to have any trouble finding anything. It's just not the sort of thing that I would have assumed you could start doing and be, like, touring regionally within months of starting to perform.
Well, Juan's just that awesome.
Well, Juan seems to be just that awesome in a lot of ways, honestly. I questioned whether Juan is somewhat of a Gary Stu character because he is, like, he's likable, he's competent, he's kind of understanding of why Sierra might be frustrated. He turns out to also be a Shadow Shaper. His music thing took off, like, the moment he started doing it. He seems to be totally cool, man.
He is totally cool.
It's a level of competence you don't often see from a non-protagonist, unless it is their mentor.
Yeah, and I think the one thing that keeps him from being, like, a full-out Gary Stu is that there's never really a moment where Sierra fucks up and he has to, like, step in and help her. Like, his particular set of skills are the only thing that will work here. I feel like that's kind of one of the traits of one of those characters where, like, they're perfect at everything, and then at some point, like, they're even more perfect than, like, the actual main characters. Not to say that Sierra or Juan is, like, 100% perfect, but... I think the book at least steers away from being like, oh, my weak teenage sister needs a man's help. Aside from the moment where he shows up and saves her, which is more of a dramatic thing as opposed to like a once she finds her power thing. So I could at least appreciate that he never stepped in and was just like, I'm the one who's saving everybody now.
Yeah, that would have been too obnoxious, first of all.
That would have been real bad. I'm like, ugh.
Yeah, it was a slight question I had. He didn't actually bother me as much as I make it sound like. I guess going back to John Wick, Keanu Reeves is in this novel. No.
Oh, God. What if Keanu Reeves played John Wick in a movie of this book?
You know, it could work. He might not be quite old enough. I don't know.
I would not approve of
that. Actually, he probably is literally old enough, but he probably doesn't play people that old yet. Because
I don't think he seems academic enough.
Like that's
personally.
Ever... Have you seen the people get cast as academics in these movies?
Okay, fair enough.
Remember when Denise Richards was a nuclear physicist in a Bond flick?
I don't watch Bond movies, so...
All right, fair enough. given your proclivities, probably a wise decision.
Yeah.
Jonathan Wick, an anthropologist, kind of caught wind of this shadow shaping thing, wanted to check it out because, I mean, that would sound interesting to anybody, I think. And he managed to befriend some of these folks and kind of live in their world for a little while, and actually had some of the ability himself, gained some of it himself, and then just kind of got corrupted by the power of it.
Yeah, he's totally a corrupted by greed and power sort of character who believed that if he had all of the power that he would do a great job with it. So he kind of thinks that he's, you know, being helpful or whatever, but he's actually just being an asshole.
Yeah, and he's the only white character in this story. I'll throw that out there.
Yeah.
Though it definitely could have gone in more of a, here's the straw man, evil white guy character direction than it did. I certainly think his idea that he, maybe that idea that he's helping but actually just kind of being a dick might be a little bit of commentary.
Right? Like, oh, I know you've been doing this for generations, but if you give me your power, I'll do it better. Like, ugh. Get out. Get out!
I lived here for 3 months, and now I totally understand how everything works.
Yeah. At least I will give credit to anthropologists as a profession. I don't think most of them are like that, so... but yeah... At the same time, he actually does, you know, have this motivation behind his corruption and his eventual, like, killing people off. So he's definitely not written just as, like, here's a white evil guy. It's like, well, here's this guy who's, like, super fucked up. Oh, and by the way, he's, like, also a white guy. So it's definitely not, like, a archetype or anything.
Yeah, I don't even know if the white guy part of it was as important as the fact that he was just an outsider trying to use this power that seems to be pretty intimately connected with a certain type of community.
Honestly, the fact that he's an academic or some like yeah. from that kind of world is kind of more of the thing.
I could see that too, for sure. Like, oh, look how fascinating this cultural thing is, and now I want to become the expert on it so that, you know, the world that matters, a.k.a. other academics, know about it.
Yeah. Newsflash academics. No one cares. Well, saying this is, you know, between two people who, well, one who's earned a master's degree and one who's currently earning a master's degree, but you know what ifs. I'm earning, like, the least academic master's degree you can earn, so. I don't even know if that's true. It's probably not true, but whatever.
Hey, you're saying that to a music major. We don't have to be able to read.
Okay.
All right. I exaggerate, of course. I guess we'll hit a couple of these side characters and then move on. Sierra's grandparents kind of, in a way, get the ball rolling, I guess. We talked about her grandfather and how he's important to the plot. It's also maybe important to note that possibly the reason all this is happening in the first place is because he's too much of a sexist to initiate his granddaughter into this power that is basically her birthright.
Yeah, I thought it was interesting because the way the book was set up, it's like, okay, Mama Carmen, her grandmother's dead. You know, Grandpa Lazaro had a stroke, but he, like, has moments of clarity. And it was kind of set up to be, like, you know, Lazaro as, like, the wise old man. But then Sierra finds out she actually has to talk to the spirit of her grandmother and discovers that, oh, no, Grandpa, like, hid the Shadow Shapers from me because he didn't want a girl to be a Shadow Shaper. But then he accepted this outsider dickhead, Jonathan Wick, into the group because, you know, he's, like, another guy. And it turns out that the grandmother was the one with all the power anyway. So he was just being stubborn because, like, her grandma. And then Sierra is, like, the person who allows the Shadow Shapers to even function, essentially.
Yeah, and it seems like maybe there's a little bit of commentary of some sort happening with that as well. It seems like a thing where maybe I am not fully in tune with the message because, you know, I'm a whitey white McWhiterson. But I could almost see it as like, hey, there's this, like, matriarchal thread and kind of this... There's kind of this matriarchal thing that is conflicting with this silly machismo thing.
Yeah, I think that is probably part of it. Again, I'm not part of that culture either, but it does seem, you know, like Grandpa Lazaro kind of wanted to have the men be in charge and, like, not admit that his wife was, like, the key to their power. And then he finally figured it out, like, after he got his ass handed to him and feels bad about it, but...
Yeah, And I guess there were some folks from the boys' club, because most of the Shadow Shapers from the older generation that were still hanging around were men, right?
Yeah, I think Sierra's grandmother is the only other female Shadow Shaper, like, besides Sierra, pretty much, that she meets during the course of this book.
Yeah, because her mother kind of rejected it.
Yeah, her mom and her aunt rejected it. They could have been, but...
And so, you know, some of these people from the boys' club, I guess, are still hanging around, being picked off one by one, and the one we get to know the best is Manny, the Domino King, presumably because he pwns everyone at Domino's.
Yeah.
And he's kind of this jovial elder statesman figure in the neighborhood, runs the community paper, encourages Sierra to do her mural work that she's doing at the beginning. I kind of wonder if his plan was to ease her into this shadow shaping thing eventually.
Yeah, it kind of sounds like at the beginning it is like, you really need to finish this as quickly as possible, but he kind of knows what's going on.
Yeah. And then, not part of the shadow shaping club, but, Uncle Neville, Sierra's vaguely criminal uncle, who seems like the, He's like the savvy older guy with a little bit of sense of mischief. I liked him in the brief periods he was involved in things.
So he drives her to Columbia and just like drops off an empty briefcase somewhere on campus to like distract everybody. And she's like, Uncle Neville, like, what if they had done something to you for that? And he, like, makes a joke about having, like, a gun in his trunk, and she doesn't actually know if that's true or not.
Oh, Uncle Neville, you're such a card. Let's get out of here. Just in case.
Basically his role in the book. Alrighty, so clearly we've already talked about some of the race issues with, like, Sierra having to deal with some of these issues, like, not being white. When she goes to Columbia to try to get into the library, she makes mention of, like, being one of the only not white people around and how it's pretty awkward. And that's, I think, why she and Nydia, like, connect so quickly, or one of the reasons, at least, why they connect so quickly. In addition to that, a couple of times when she goes different places and she mentions, like, they've changed a lot from what she's used to, like, gotten a lot more high scale, she also notices there are a lot more white people around than she's used to, which I thought was kind of interesting, with people who have lived somewhere, like, having to deal with those updates and then inevitably the rich white people moving into the area. And then one aspect that was interesting was Sierra's aunt is racist, but not like a I hate white people sort of like thing that you might expect. But so Robbie, I guess we did not mention, is Haitian. And when Sierra talks about him to her mom and her aunt makes some comment about, well, like, you know what they say about Haitians? They're super dark, and you probably don't want to date a dark guy. And she's like, wow, okay.
who is the they that says that, Auntie? Giant racists?
Yeah. She actually calls her out on it at one point. It's like, I'm sick of you being a racist asshole. Which is pretty awesome, in my opinion.
Yeah, it takes a not insignificant amount of spine to do that as a teenager to an adult.
Yeah, and it was cool because it brought up this issue of, you know, like, other forms of racism that exist in the world because humans are kind of terrible, all groups tend to judge other groups that are different from them, so...
It's true, we're never gonna find them all.
Yeah.
We're always gonna find little things to categorize people as, I guess...
Well, you know, like, thousands of years from now, when everyone's about the same color, there's going to be something else going on, so...
Yeah, when we're all just, like, a bunch of golden-colored pansexuals, we'll have to figure out what the new thing is.
Pansexuals.
Yeah.
But yeah, this book, like, brings up a lot of different things. It's kind of just, like, woven into the book, but in a way that's not, like, constantly just hitting you over the head with it. So it's really nice because YA novels don't always deal with this issue. And if they do, sometimes they do, like, a little more ham-fisted. And so this felt very authentic to me of, like, just here's what not white people will have to deal with sometimes, and like it's kind of a part of life, and you know, I'll point it out for you a couple times, but we won't make it like the crux of the book.
Yeah, and just, I mean, and even when it was being pointed out, like, that it was usually a little more subtle, like, oh, it just felt a little uncomfortable being the only not white person in a place. But no one was, like, being a jackass to her in those moments. It was just the being, like, that not belonging feeling.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And I guess we already discussed, like, the sexism issue, like, with her family and her grandpa trying to keep shadow shaping from her. So we can kind of skip over that.
Well, and that's actually the exact reason why it's good that Juan didn't have to step in at some point and be like, I have the power.
Or Robbie, for that matter. Like, Robbie, you know, taught her, like, how everything works, but then once she started putting it into practice, she was, like, really good at it, so... And she, like, learned from him without him being like, all right, little woman, let me explain to you how this works. She's like, oh, Robbie, like, did this cool thing. I'm going to try to do something like that. So she, like, was figuring shit out on her own all the time instead of, like, having it all mansplained to her constantly.
Yeah. And then she has, in her group of friends, there's a... there's a lesbian couple, and they're, like, it's not really ever pointed out or acknowledged. It's just like, oh, these are our friends.
They're dating each other.
Yeah.
Okay, moving on.
It's a thing.
Yeah. So Ben and I were kind of pointing out that this was, like, good and funny kind of at the same time, because, like, on one point, it's becoming, like, more and more common to have gay characters in your books and, like, hanging out with everyone else, and it's not, like, their defining characteristic is, like, you are gay and dealing with that. So it's just like, oh, yeah, I have some friends who happen to be gay, but, you know, they're my friends, and the point is, like, we enjoy hanging out with each other. But then Ben was saying that it's almost starting to feel like a point on a checklist for authors, like, YA authors being like, all right, do you have the gay friend in there?
Yeah, and I mean, to be fair, if I was going to write something, you know, maybe when I do my annual nano failure coming up here soon. it's tradition. I have to get 10,000 to 20,000 words in and then completely lose interest. but it almost feels like a thing you have to do right now, and I don't know why that is, but...
to see more LGBT characters in all books. Like, I have no problem with that. But, you know, like, why don't you maybe make the protagonist gay without it being the absolute center of their storyline?
Right.
That's a possibility. Like, you could tell, and not this book necessarily, but just as an example, like, you could write this book pretty much exactly the same, but make Robbie a girl instead of a guy, and it would basically be the same book. So you can do something like that very easily.
Yeah, I almost wonder, and probably there'd be more things to tweak than I think, but to write a story and then just, like, drop all of the characters' names into a hat and then start, like, rolling dice to determine what gender and sexuality they're going to be as you pull them out. And then just going back in and altering all the pronouns.
And then sounds like an interesting experiment.
Yeah, and then reread it and see if it feels, like, even remotely real, or if it's like, no, I guess, I don't know, you'd probably have to write well enough to make characters actually seem like they were male and female, not just generic, like, snark bots or something.
Yeah. but, I mean, that's a fair point. Like, it happens occasionally. I mean, not so much books, but, like, the classic example of Alien, where Ripley was originally supposed to be a guy, and then, I don't remember why, but they changed the gender and basically changed nothing else about the character.
Probably because Sigourney Weaver walked into the room and they're like, look at that fucking badass.
All right, we're sold. You want us over. Okay, so themes of the book. If you get powers, don't make zombies that hurt people.
Yeah, don't be an ass.
It's a pretty typical theme that we bring up quite often.
Yeah, don't be a dick is one of the biggest themes of all books, but YA in particular.
Yeah.
Accepting who you are, finding yourself, that kind of idea, which again in YA, pretty common.
Mm-hmm. The power of art and, like, the spiritual connections you can make with art and creating art.
expression and all of those good things. And then power corrupts. The corruption of power, a common theme in certainly epic type stories, even when they're short fantasy stories, like to go pretty black and white on the good versus bad side of things most of the time. It certainly doesn't only happen with supernatural stories, but we haven't read like a lot of political type thrillers that might fit the niche as well in the same way.
Yeah.
But also certainly a pretty common theme. I think it's an easy way to write a villain who seems to have like some motivations beyond being evil is fun.
Yeah.
Though if you're going to write that kind of villain, you should really just go all out with it. No, I'm going to throw
that in there. Balls to the wall.
Oh, yeah.
For real.
Because that idea of like being ambitious and wanting to... Some of them even want to change things because they think they're doing a good thing.
Yeah, it's kind of a thing where, like, if you want power, then it's going to corrupt you, but if you get power thrust upon you without asking for it, then you're going to be a good leader. Like, that type of thing is going on in this book. Where, like, Sierra's grandma's just like, by the way, you're in charge. And she's like, oh, okay. And she, like, does great at it. And then Wick, who, like, wanted to be in charge, became an evil guy who kills people, so.
Yeah, or I'm thinking of, one of the hardcore history episodes, Dan Carlin was asking if all the bad things Caesar did to get power were canceled out by all the actual good things he did when he had power.
Mm-hmm.
It's like, are having motivations of ambition and power, does the motivation even matter when you, for like most of the people, well, let's be clear with Caesar, the people you're ruling, because he killed a hell of a lot of the people who lived in other places. But, like, is all that authentically good stuff you did for them, is it canceled out by your motivations possibly being shitty?
Yeah, or Alexander the Great, kind of the same thing. Like,
yeah,
you, like, brought some people together and instituted some good laws, and then you, like, traipsed into India and genocided a bunch of people and tried to take over the world. So I don't know, like, you're pretty crazy.
I think it's an interesting question, though. That being said, John Wick was not that deep of a character.
No, yeah, he was he wasn't doing a lot of good for people, so. Alrighty.
Yeah, so I guess we said the murals were symbols already.
Yep.
Our points of interest, I mentioned that the banter between the friends felt a little bit different. There was, I don't know, it didn't feel as white. That's the best way I can think to describe it. And that sounds like a really bad way to describe it.
Yes, it does.
But, let's see. It wasn't like a stereotypical thing. It wasn't like a Hollywood concept of here's what people in the barrio sound like when they hang out.
No, yeah.
It just had a slightly different flavor to it than your typical YA protagonists and their friends like ribbing each other, I guess.
And I think part of that is this author is more willing to have his characters speak in non-standard English.
Yeah, I think that helps.
And, I mean, that is a thing that some, cultures embrace about themselves, is not speaking in standard English. So there is a way to, like, you know, and in books with white characters, I think it's a lot more common to have them all speaking in standard English. So, I mean, that might be part of it.
Yeah, maybe that makes it come across as a little stilted sometimes.
Mm-hmm.
Because, you know, you write something that seems just oh so clever when you put pen to page, and then when you're reading it as dialogue, when you're a different, when you're a stranger reading what was written as dialogue, you know, I can even read something like that and go, oh, that's clever, but it's not something someone would ever say in real life. And with some writers who are really good at that, I like it. But sometimes it just, it's a little too obvious you're reading a book, maybe.
Yeah, so like I was thinking one good YA example of an author who writes dialogue that we both enjoyed but is not realistic at all is John Green.
Oh, yeah.
Where a lot of the times in The Fault in Our Stars we're like, oh man, the banter between them was great, but it's not the way teenagers talk.
It's not the way anybody talks.
Yeah, and Shadow Shaper is like very different and removed from that, where like this is actually the way like friends would like shoot the shit at each other.
Yeah.
So
there is also art battles. That was neat. I really
we
thought
wanted
that
the dragon to do more.
Yeah, I really thought that giant dragon she was I thought that was a Chekhov's dragon situation.
Yeah, yeah. Totally.
And not so much.
One of my favorite moments, it was just like a small thing, was when she's kind of with her group of people and they're headed to go to the warehouse to find Wick. And someone says, you know what, you should like really fill everyone in on all the details just so they can decide whether or not they want to be involved. And they get to like a subway stop basically, and she's like, you know, if this is too much for you, you don't have to stick around. And a couple of them actually do go, you know what? Yeah, I think I have to go. That's a little too much for me. But I thought it was interesting because in those moments where heroes say those sorts of things, it's usually everyone's like, no, we would never leave you, of course. Or people do leave, but they're like painted as cowards and like not true friends.
Right.
And in this case, like a couple of those people who leave, like show up at the end of the book and like they're still buddies. So they're definitely like not judged for it.
Yeah, like in epic fantasy, that opportunity to leave would happen at the same point in the story, and then they would leave, and then there'd be 9 more books where they never showed up because they're not true companions.
Yeah, so I thought it was kind of interesting. Like, you don't often see that. And one of the things I thought was interesting was you mentioned, like, two of the friends are dating. And one half of the couple decided to peace out, and the other half of the couple was like, no, of course I'm staying. But then that didn't, like, make them break up or something. So I thought that was kind of interesting, too.
Yeah, there was no romantic retribution for half of them not wanting to take place in the final battle.
Yeah, this was kind of cool.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, and I guess the supernatural creatures that were involved, the not-zombies...
They're called, like, corpsicles or something like that.
Yeah.
Corpuscles? I don't know.
And then the Thronghaints, which are, like, a bunch of spirits welded together into one creepy shadow creature.
Yeah, like, so the spirits in this book are not necessarily, like, scary or malevolent spirits. Like, most of them just kind of, like, want to do stuff and hang out. But the Thronghaints are the more... sinister version where you're forcing a bunch of spirits to do this thing maybe against their will, even as opposed to the Shadow Shapers, who, you know, have willing spirits flowing into their works. So the Thronghaints are very dangerous
indeed.
Indeed.
So strengths and weaknesses of the writing.
Yeah, so, I mean, one thing we kind of already mentioned was that occasionally the plot seems to be moving at, like, breakneck speed. I'd be reading, and I was like, okay, there's a setup, and then, like, it was happening 3 pages later, and I was like, whoa, what? And then, like, someone's, like, running off, and here's a thing. So, occasionally, I thought, personally, like, sometimes it moved too fast for me, and I got kind of confused, and I thought... maybe that some parts of it could be fleshed out a little more to help, like, and I think part of it was, like, sometimes the pacing moved really fast, and other times it didn't, so sometimes it felt kind of uneven, like, in the pacing arena.
Yeah, and I would generally agree with that. You know, specifically, we had mentioned that the suspicions of whether Robbie and Nydia were trustworthy got resolved very quickly.
Yeah.
It was, I guess, kind of the flip side to it is that it also, despite the fact that we're kind of learning about this new universe, I guess, with the premise of the magical system and all that, there was never like a, there was like definitely an exposition type of chapter where they're exploring the power a little bit, but there was never like a giant info dump that you had to get through so you would understand what the hell was happening in the rest of the story.
Yeah.
Because that, anytime, I mean, any science fiction, fantasy, supernatural type premise, there's always a risk of that happening. And in fact, most stories don't do a great job of avoiding it, even the ones that are actually pretty good.
Well, like, for example, Harry Potter, which everyone loves, like, the end of a lot of those books is just a chapter of Dumbledore being like, let me explain everything to you in one chapter.
Right. So for those of you who haven't figured out what the hell is going on, here it is succinctly. Thanks, Dumbledore.
All right. And then one other thing I was just going to bring up that bothered me in this book was at one point it mentioned that she went to the gas station to get, like, an icy or Slurpee or whatever, and I was like, totally cool. And then it said she also bought gum, and I was like, why would you chew gum and drink an icy at the same time? It would just make your gum rock hard. That's a terrible idea. It really bothered me. Because I kept imagining, like, chewing gross hard gum while drinking an icy, and it was like setting my teeth on edge.
It just ruined the book for me.
God. Anyway, but strengths of the writing. As we've already also talked about, we liked the diversity and culture, like, mixing up YA and actually making it, like, different from a lot of the other YA out there, even though it had, like, a lot of the same, like, story beats. And the premise was cool, like, something I've never read before.
Yeah, using spirits to make living art.
Yeah, that was cool.
Neat. It could visually, possibly, make a pretty good movie, I don't know.
Yeah.
And why?
I don't know if they'll ever make it, because it's about people who are not white, and Hollywood is bad at that.
Well, that's true. So, do you have any questions?
I still want to know what the F is up with Robbie, like, what his deal is.
Fair enough.
And there were these characters, beings, that kind of showed up briefly, called the Sorrows, and I had a hard time figuring out exactly what their deal was. Like, were they good? Were they bad? Were they neutral? What did they do? Why did they show up? They're really intriguing, but then, like, we never really learned that much about them.
Yeah, it's kind of this, here is this giant power that you just shouldn't mess with, and it's really mysterious, and they're going to show up just long enough to confirm that they're actually a thing and not a legend, and then they're not going to do anything to alter events, and good luck with that.
They're like, oh, Sierra, there's no way you could possibly defeat Wick now, and she's like, oh, really?
It's like, oh, really cool.
Sorrows are worthless, jeez.
So,
your verdict?
Yeah, I enjoyed it. It reads quickly. I thought the premise was interesting. I liked that it was a little bit different, a little bit different flavor of YA.
Yeah, I kind of thought the same thing. I thought it was a pretty cool story. It read fast. I had some issues with it. Like, afterwards, I wasn't sure how memorable all of the characters were. But, you know, like, nothing about the book bothered me so much that it made me want to stop reading it while I was reading it. So I was down.
All right, what you reading right now?
So I just finished reading a book called The Marriage of Opposites by Alice Hoffman, who also wrote a book called The Dove Keepers that apparently everyone's read, but I've never heard of. It is, like, extremely typical. I hate saying this, but like, here's a bestseller written by a woman about a woman. It's like in that book. And I just didn't care about it that much. And it ended up being like about her dumb butt son, who's like an impressionist artist. So he's all whiny and talking about, ugh, I was just like, go away. But I did learn some kind of cool stuff about, like, this island called St. Thomas and, like, the history of Jewish people who lived there, so that's, like, pretty cool. And I just started reading a book, A Scary Story, called The Cipher by Kathy Koja, and it's about a weird hole in a guy's apartment building that does creepy things, so, yeah.
Neat. Creepy thing hole.
Yeah, they call it the fun hole, which is like...
That makes it even creepier, honestly. at the time we did this outline, I had just finished Volume 1 of Saga by Brian K. Vaughan and Fiona Staples, which is, in fact, a... I guess, graphic novel, more of a collection of the comics than a full-length novel, even for a graphic novel. And it's basically because I'm trying to poach things off of the challenged book list occasionally. And that's on there, and it doesn't really seem to have any more sex and violence and weirdness than other... comics and graphic novel type things I've come across, but the woman has her breast exposed to feed her baby on the cover, and that probably made a bunch of people freak out. That's my best guess.
Oh my god.
Yeah, right.
How dare you do a thing women have been doing for thousands of years.
I know, you put that filthy thing away.
It's pornographic.
That's right. So currently I am reading 1491 by Charles C. Mann, which is about what the Americas were like right before the Europeans showed up for good, I guess, if you want to be fair to the Vikings. But
yeah,
since the story of Europeans arriving in the Americas is pretty unfair to the Native Americans, I guess we'll let it go. And it's a pretty damn interesting book. So thanks, Gabs. It was a gift from her.
It was one of those books where I was like, this sounds cool. Maybe Ben will lend it to me one day.
Happily. So I guess if you have any questions or comments, or you want to tell Gabs she's doing a great job despite the... obstructions I keep putting in her way on this podcast. You can leave a comment on our website, novelideaspodcast.com.
You can find us on Twitter. Ben pretty much runs the Novel Ideas Twitter. That's at Novel Ideas Pod. And you can find me at Classic Sum Up.
And we are on iTunes. And you can also, you know, rate and review and do all that good stuff there. I guess if enough of you do that, we get higher up their rankings and are more likely to show up in places where more people see it. So, you know.
And our logo shows up on iTunes now, so we don't even look like unprofessional hacks. After like 2 years of doing a podcast.
We could maybe go up from dozen of followers to dozens of followers.
Woohoo! Woohoo! We are also part of the Minerva Podcast Network, so if you found us via iTunes or our website, you can also find us over at www.minervamag.com, which is an awesome online magazine about geeky stuff, and I'm involved with that, so I like it. But I recommend you check it out.
I also like it. I read it. I read it a couple times a week.
Hooray! And we have four podcasts now, officially in the Minerva Podcast Network, so you can check out three other geeky podcasts there if you're looking for more of this flavor.
Yeah, our next, I don't know when it'll be, it could be years at our current rate of releasing episodes, but our next Shakespeare podcast, we need to do some crossover work, maybe.
Yeah, with Bardolatry?
Yeah.
Yeah, we actually had Tony on the latest Bardolatry episode.
Well,
so.
How could you not?
Yeah.
If I can ever drag my ass to Boston, maybe, I don't know. So anyway, unless I'm missing something, I think that will do it this week.
That is it.
And we'll see you next time.
Bye.